This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the New York State Parole Board's recent decision to release Herman Bell.
About two-thirds of prisoners, both in New York and nationally, are in there because of violent crimes. If we're going to reverse the mass incarceration in the United States of America, this has to be addressed. The Herman Bell case is a tough one.
On the 10th anniversary of the Brooklyn Folk Festival, we talk with organizer and musician Eli Smith.
This is our music. This is non-commercial music, just like this radio station. Listen in and come down to the festival.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. After serving 45 years in prison, 70-year-old Herman Bell was recently granted parole in his eighth appearance before the New York State Parole Board. Not surprisingly, the decision of the three-member panel was criticized by the police union, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, and New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo, all of whom have urged the board to reverse its decision. Herman Bell was born in Mississippi and moved to Brooklyn, New York as a boy. A talented high school football player, he won a football scholarship to the University of California in Oakland. While there, Herman joined the Black Panther Party and became active around human rights issues in the black community. In 1971, he went underground because of FBI attacks on the Black Panther Party. While underground, Herman joined the Black Liberation Army, and in September 1973, he was captured and extradited to New York on charges of having killed two New York City police officers, a charge for which Jaleel Muntaquim and New Washington were already serving time. No witnesses were able to put Herman at the scene of the crime. His first trial ended in a hung jury, and he was convicted at his second trial and sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. Joining us to talk about why the parole board changed its decision after seven previous hearings are Laura Whitehorn and Jose Saldana. Jose and Laura, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jose, were you surprised at the parole board's granting of parole to Herman?
I was very surprised, but I thought he had a slim chance. I didn't give him too much of a chance in the prior parole board hearings, but I thought he had a very slim chance.
How about you, Laura? What did you think?
Well, I felt the same, but I was hoping, because Jose and I and so many other people have been pushing for so long that the parole regulations and the parole commissioners should reflect the fundamental purpose of parole, which is to look at who a person is today, not who they were 45 years ago. And so I was hopeful that those changes would apply to everyone, no matter how high profile the case. On the other hand, I know that politicians and parole commissioners are sometimes afraid of getting the kind of blowback that they actually got. So I think what was really amazing to me and really encouraging was to see that the commissioners and the board had the courage to stand by the law and by the forward-looking changes that have been made to parole practices that allow for a person to be judged on who he or she is. And I think it took courage and it took principle, and I'm really glad to see that they had it.
The composition of the parole board has recently changed, and that, of course, was helpful in making that shift of how they determine whether someone should be granted parole. What kind of work went into changing the composition of the board?
Well, there was a grassroots movement, RAP, as well as other groups. You had the prison ministry at Riverside Church. So many people were involved in this, and there was a bill that I was a part of actually drafting called TIP, or Truth in Parole Act. And that actually, one of the major differences between that and the Safe Parole Act is that it called for the changing of the composition at the parole board to reflect communities we come from, or people from behavioral sciences rather than law enforcement.
It's just that Jose's being modest. I mean, yes, the bill, but you did so much more. The incarcerated people were part of the beginning of this movement by doing something very important, which is analyzing what the problems with the parole practice were and pointing to what had to be changed. And then, more recently, last year, the beginning of the actual change in the parole commissioners happened when the governor who appoints them had his staff meet with activists and advocates who showed them the illegalities that were being perpetrated by the parole commissioners who, as Jose says, had law enforcement backgrounds, who were treating the parole process as not only a second trial, but a second trial with no constitutional protections, no legal protections for the defendant. So the governor's people were kind of shocked by that because no one knew what was going on in the parole process until, starting with incarcerated people, formerly incarcerated people, we said this is important to our communities because we'll never end mass incarceration if people who deserve a second chance are not given it.
Now, instead of looking back at the nature of the original crime, what specifically does the parole board look at now?
You know, before I used to prepare parole packages, and they wouldn't even look at them. My entire family would work for a whole year to prepare my parole package. And the best that they did with it was look at it and just flip it. You know, so that was so discouraging. But now they actually look just about almost every support letter, all the programs that I've developed. They ask me about them. They ask me, why did I develop these programs when the Department of Correction offered an anti-aggression program? I told them they were shortcomings in the programs that they offered.
Let's talk about the response publicly. The police union has issued a, quote, safety alert, supposedly to provide backup, as they say, to NYPD officers if Herman is released. Do you think that's a public relations gimmick?
I think Lois can respond to that a lot better than me.
What do you have to say, Laura?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to make the point that, and, you know, some of you doing the interviews on this show are as old as I am, so we remember that when the civil rights movement was actually making progress, it was the sheriffs and the police who responded with threats, intimidation, and violence. And I think that we see that every time there's a move towards social justice. And we've seen that also around the push to end solitary confinement, not just in New York State, but around the country, that the one voice standing against it and pushing for more solitary confinement was the voice of the police organizations and correctional officers organizations, the so-called unions in New York State. So it's not surprising, but it is shocking that they think they can get away with that. I mean, what authority does the Patrolman Benevolent Association have to issue a warning to the NYPD? They're not their boss. And so they sent out a totally inappropriate, threatening, all-points bulletin, basically. And then they stood up and said, we're going to get you. They literally used those words directed to Herman. So I think that they are trying, it's not just public relations, it's an actual attempt to intimidate. And, you know, it kind of worked because Governor Cuomo and Bill de Blasio, both of whom, especially Bill de Blasio, have been threatened by the police before when they turned their backs on him and then they told him he had blood on his hands and all of that. They want to run the state. They think that the law is not an instrument that should apply to everyone. They think the law is what they say and what they do. And so I think that it's significant that there have been so many people in the community who have taken a stand against this. You know, we have 120 or more organizations who signed on to a letter. I don't know how many, maybe it's 1,000 by now, artists. We have a CBS poll that had 6,000 participants, and people voted for by 85 or 86% to whatever the balance is, 14%, I guess, voted for Herman's parole. We had a former parole commissioner who wrote a letter to the New York Times today. The New York Times had an editorial supporting what the board did. So, you know, the police are trying to undo all of this. They're trying to control the process, and they're trying to put the brakes on any advance in social justice. And let's be clear, the parole process, mass incarceration, stop and frisk, all of these things are at base part of a racist system that people have been trying to overturn, and I don't mean overthrow, I mean overturn in terms of getting some social justice and getting equal treatment for everyone, no matter what race or, you know, where you come from or whatever. And that is not an easy task, obviously. So here we are in 2018, seeing the same kind of bullying from the police that we've seen for, you know, for my entire lifetime, I can say that.
Laura, Jose, I think our listeners know that the United States is the main imprisoner of people in the world, with 25% of all prisoners being in the United States, even though the United States is only 5% of the population of the world. So we have a mass incarceration situation, a racist situation, because most prisoners are non-white. And we have a situation where a lot of the prisoners, if I'm correct, I think it was like 61%, are in prison for violent crime. So if we're going to reverse the situation of mass incarceration, we have to address the situation of prisoners who are in for violent crimes. And there was an adage that we learned in law school that hard cases make bad law. What I'm afraid of is that the hardest case you could imagine of a person that killed two police officers is now become the poster child for the Policeman's Benevolent Association. If we lose this one, it could be a precedent for other people who are coming up. And I wanted your thoughts on that.
Well, I think there's a flip side to that, because if we win it, look at the encouragement that it gives people, because if he wins it, and I believe he will, it will be on the merits of his character, of the person he is today. And I know, and a lot of us that have did time and have been released, we know the influence that Herman Bell has had on countless people throughout the New York State prison system. And I think that's important that people understand that he not only has transformed his life, but he has transformed the lives of so many people. And as I always say, that most of the people right now that are formerly incarcerated and involved in gang prevention and anti-violent movement have been influenced by Herman Bell. And that's a testament to the man that he is today. If they fail, it's a victory for all of us.
And I wanted to make two other points based on what Jose just said. One is that, you know, it's one thing to take responsibility by apologizing and by saying certain words, which you have to, you know, show some sincerity when you say those words. But, you know, that's one piece of expressing remorse. Another piece is what you do. Herman, and I know this because I've talked to him for years and visited him, he has seen how violence in the community has grown through the way that the police have responded to the social movements of the 60s and the 70s and all of that. And he has taken it upon himself to do exactly what Jose just said. The other thing is, I know that that's a thing that lawyers say, that hard cases make bad law. But as a non-lawyer, I feel a little trepidation. But I feel like hard cases also make the best law. For example, if we're dealing with the death penalty, to have saved the life of Trayvon Martin, someone who's clearly innocent or has a real claim to innocence, is a good thing. But it doesn't end the death penalty. If we can win the point that someone who is guilty of a crime should not be put to death, then that actually makes a more fundamental change. So yeah, we have to fight it on all fronts. And I totally agree with Jose that this is a key case, because they're saying this man's case just about the highest profile you can get in New York State. And yet the board, the commissioners had the courage to look at who he is today, to follow the law, to exert a law, a legal framework, which is more fair and more just. And no matter what happens, we have to keep pushing. And we need more people to be interested in this question of parole, because you're right, Michael, it's actually 67% in New York State, I think, of incarcerated people are convicted of crimes of violence. And so, you know, any quote reform that ignores those people, and any reform like some of the governor's geriatric parole things that say you can get compassionate release but not if you're guilty of killing a cop, anything that excludes just by a broad spectrum a category of convictions that people have will not get us to where we need to go to reverse exactly what you said about the mass incarceration.
We understand that Herman is due to be released in mid-April. Do you think there is a chance that this pressure from the union, the mayor and the governor, could even result in a change in that decision?
We hope not, and we think it would be a total violation of of law.
Yeah.
If they did. The man has been to the board 8 times. Every aspect of his character, his life, his prison record, the crime, every conviction that he might have, everything has been looked at and looked at and looked at. And there is no basis now to say, oops, we forgot. We forgot to look at this. We forgot to look at that. It's all been out there.
I read that the parole board cited a specific letter. It called it noteworthy from a person. Although it didn't name the person, it was thought to be from Officer Jones's son, who wrote, quote, "The simple answer is, it would bring joy and peace," referring to the release of Herman, "as we have already forgiven Herman Bell publicly. On the other hand, to deny him parole again would cause us pain, as we're reminded of the painful episode each time he appears before the board." We understand the family is split in their reaction to the parole board's decision. But I assume that letters like this from a family of a person who was the victim of a crime mean a lot to the board.
That is so rare. I can't recall hearing a case like that, especially when it involved a police officer's family. And I commend that man. It took an overwhelming amount of courage and faith and a sense of humane justice to actually not just feel the way he does, but let the public know how he feels about it. That's awesome. And you just can't deny that.
What is Herman's support network like on the outside? I assume he has wide support.
Huge. Huge support. In fact, more than we thought. Because, as I said, there was a CBS poll, and 6,000 people participated in 2 days. You know, we've had requests, what can we do, what can we do, from people who don't necessarily know him. Some do. And I did want to make one other point that, you know, this morning I was reading the New York Times and Alton Sterling's killers, the cops who killed him in a very obvious case of brutality, are not going to be tried. Now, that's not my point, isn't, you know, equal justice, blah, blah. But my point is, whenever we have police officers who do go on trial, or where grand juries or prosecutors are investigating, should they try them, we always hear so much about the state of mind of the cops. You know, they feared for their lives, they were this, they were that. They get to be looked at as individuals with something that, the, you know, all of a sudden we hear that police are afraid, which we don't normally hear, but then when they kill someone, they say it's because they were afraid for their lives. But my point is, they get the benefit of the doubt. They get to be looked at. I have been really struck in all of the shrieking by the police and some right-wing politicians about Herman that none of them has shown a shred of curiosity about the fact that parole commissioners could look at him and say, this is an interesting and changed person. So, you know, it's just one other aspect of racism that we don't necessarily think of, which is who gets to be seen as a human being with the capacity to change and with things to say and feelings and all of that. And, you know, we see that we're pushing for the parole board to begin to make judgments based on that, and we see that they are beginning to do that. But it's a far cry from having it be accepted by those who have, you know, martial power or state power or whatever you want to call it when you talk about the police organizations.
Jose, you mentioned earlier that you went before the parole board the last time in January. Is that of this year, 2000?
Yes.
And so you were just recently released.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
If you don't mind sharing for our audience, how many years were you inside?
A total of 38 years.
38 years.
And I want to add that normally these interviews take from 6 to 10 minutes. And 10 minutes is a long interview. So they're making a decision in 6 to 10 minutes. I've been informed that Herman's hearing lasted 2 hours. So they were thorough. You know, I mean, they were just so, I mean, that's unheard of, first of all. So you can imagine what the exchange of dialogue, and them going over all the support that he had.
Is that the kind of thing that they did with you, Jose? Can you give us some of the highlights of the questions they asked you when you were interviewed for your successful parole application?
My case involved a New York City police officer, too. He didn't die. He was wounded in exchange of gunfire. This is a high-profile case, a lot of concern with the law enforcement. She actually had a letter in her hand. She said, I see that you're going to be living with your wife, and I see this letter, and then she said, where I'm going to be living, your daughters, your sons, your brothers. I see we have a letter here from the prison ministry. We have a letter from Children of Promise. You know, and she asked me, how do I feel about the crime? I told her Sergeant Patrick Palacano was a courageous man because he gave me the opportunity to surrender. He didn't come out guns blazing. He gave me the opportunity to surrender, and I didn't accept that opportunity. So, looking back, he's a courageous man. He knew that I was armed, and he still gave me the opportunity to surrender. And I feel sorry for his family. I know the impact that this crime did have on his family. His family's a lifetime victims now. And grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren would be impacted by this crime. So, and then she said, okay, let's move on now. What do you plan on doing? I told her that I would like to be a drug counselor and work as a mentor to some of these churches that have children that need help. What qualifies me? I said, I've been doing this for a couple of decades now. I think that qualifies me. And we've had failures in the programs that I run, but we've also had successes. And I see people right now that are out there involved in community social work that were in my classes. So, you know, and I feel great about that. And she said, you should. She asked me, how does my wife feel about me being incarcerated? And I was very frank with her. I said, last time I went to the board, in fact, from 2012, she's been devastated. I mean, she had to go to counseling. That's how difficult it is for her. I said, it's difficult for any woman to be married to a man in prison. And she said, well, she must be an angel. You know, and that kind of, you know, that kind of struck me. I said, well, almost. She said, what do you mean almost? I said, well, I think you have to die to be an angel. I don't want her to die.
In Herman's case, they actually did talk about the nature of the crime quite a bit, and they considered the community opposition quite a bit. So those, because they do have to take, I mean, one of the factors, what's changed is that the factors are not equivalent. There is one overriding principle, which is risk and needs assessments. And that means not just the COMPASS test that they give, which is sort of an actuarial table kind of thing with many, many, many questions and an interview to show what the risk of recidivism is, what the risk of committing a new crime, of violating your conditions of parole, of absconding, you know, all those things. But also sort of from exactly what Jose is saying about what's the content of the work that you say you're going to do? Are you just slapping something up there and saying, oh, I'm going to be a farmer? Or are you actually thinking in a real way about what you're going to do during the very difficult process of reentry after people leave prison? So the board is considering all the factors, your record inside prison, both for good and bad, your disciplinary record, your achievements, your community support, all those things. But they also are considering the nature of the crime. And one other thing, there is no factor for community opposition. It's just not in there. So what the board and what the police are pushing now, and Senator Gallivan, who's the head of, unfortunately, the head in the Senate of the Crime Committee, who's been trying to hold back these advances, although he hasn't been able to, which is why he actually affirmed these commissioners and affirmed one of them more than once. So he can't now complain and say they should be fired. But what he's trying to do is say that community opposition shows that if a person gets out, that would create disrespect for the law, that would undermine respect for the law. And what we're saying is, no. What undermines respect for the law is when the law is applied differentially to different communities, when the letter of the law is not followed, and when the law is used to keep certain groups of people under the control of other groups of people. And so the decision in Herman Bell's case actually enhances respect for the law, because it says you can, number one, everyone is entitled to a second chance, not just rich white people, not just police, but everyone. And second of all, it says there are processes by which you can adjudicate and change and alter the horrible situation that this country has been in, with so many people in prison and so many communities and families damaged by that.
It seems to me that the essence of the opposition to Herman Bell and other people who've been convicted of violent crimes, the essence of the opposition is essentially vengeance. And the Times had an excellent editorial that said that vengeance is not supposed to guide a system of justice. And one of the former parole commissioners, Barbara Treen, wrote in response to that editorial, she said, "Victims who call for eternal lockup should also know that vengeance doesn't heal." And I wanted your thoughts on that.
I think that the officer's son is the prime example. I think he was looking for closure. And to see that this man has transformed not only his life, but the lives of so many others, I think that's a very fair sense of closure for everyone, the entire family.
Totally. And, you know, there's actually a survey, a study that was done, I don't know, 2 years ago. People can find it on rapcampaign.com under reports, called Crime Survivors Speak. And it is actually the survivors of crime answering questions about their feelings and their sense of what brings closure. Something like, I think it was 67% of the people who were interviewed, it was a very large study, said that what would bring them healing was to know that the person who had committed the crime had changed, had been rehabilitated, not to have that person in prison forever. And just one other thing is that parole shouldn't be not popularity contest. That sort of sounds like it's trivializing people's pain, because obviously, I mean, it's really sad seeing Mrs. Piacentini, the wife of one of the officers, face as she's being asked, I don't want to say dragged because it sounds like she doesn't want to do it and she probably does, to one after another press conference by the PBA. And so it's just ironic that they're talking about they're trying to protect the feelings of the families, and they're exploiting the pain over and over again. But whatever that is, we have laws, we have trials, we have a whole system which is based on the idea that we don't want an eye for an eye. We don't want the Hatfields and the McCoys. We don't want, you hurt me and I decide what happens to you. My opinion and my pain is important going into something, but it's not the only factor. And that's what we're saying. That's why we are pushing a system of parole which does look at the damage that crime does and that violence does, but that says the way to get beyond that is not permanent punishment and just permanent fighting back and forth. You hurt me. Well, you hurt me. But is more a system that would restore justice by having a different narrative and a different approach to resolving the problem of crime and pain in our society.
How can our listeners get involved or learn more about your work?
They can go to RAP's website, Release Aging People in Prison. Our website is RAP Campaign, RAPPCampaign.com. But on Herman, they can use the Twitter handle. We don't have a website or anything because this isn't exactly a campaign. It's part of a larger struggle. So the Twitter handle that they can look at is hashtag Bring Herman Home. You know, all one word, as you do on Twitter.
Well,
Bring Herman Home.
Hopefully.
And then we're asking people to write letters and emails and calls to the governor, telling him that he should affirm this decision instead of disagreeing with it. They can write letters to their local newspapers, as Barbara Treen did, express their support for Herman Bell's release, but also, more important in some ways, for the overall trend in the parole system in New York toward justice.
Laura and Jose, thank you so much. We hope that the next time you're on, it will be hashtag Herman is home.
Yeah, we do.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much, Jose. Thank you, Laura. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Brooklyn Folk Festival is coming up April 6th, 7th, and 8th at the historic St. Anne's Church in downtown Brooklyn. The Brooklyn Folk Festival celebrates and presents the best in American and world folk music with 30-plus performances, workshops, film screenings, jam sessions, vocal and instrumental workshops, a square dance, and their famous banjo toss contest. The festival was started 9 years ago by Eli Smith and the Jalopy Theater and School of Music. It's a substantial and unique community event. Brooklyn has become the center of the folk scene in America. Folk or old-time music runs counter to the commercial establishment music scene. It is truly a people's music. It is non-commercial, non-corporate, and not a generator of huge profits. As a result, this music, which should be central to American culture, has been downplayed and sidelined. We know of some of its most famous proponents, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan. But there are many great unknown folk musicians whose art is perpetuated and expanded on at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. Here to talk to us today about this people's music is Eli Smith, the founder and main organizer, along with the Jalopy Theater, of the Brooklyn Folk Festival. Eli Smith is a banjo player and folk musician. He plays with the band called the Downhill Strugglers. He's a Folkways recording artist and has played around the country, including the Library of Congress and the Kennedy Center.
Eli Smith, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
If you would, please tell us about the Jalopy Theater and the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
Well, the Jalopy Theater is a community cultural organization located on Columbia Street in Red Hook, Brooklyn. It's been open since 2007 and is a home for folk and traditional grassroots, down-home, people's music here in New York City. It's a wonderful place. It's a theater. It has a stage for music and performances, as well as a music school and a record label. and a bar and restaurant. And the largest yearly production of the Jalopy Theater is the Brooklyn Folk Festival. It's kind of the focus of our year. And this is our 10th year. It's the 10th annual Brooklyn Folk Festival coming up April 6th, 7th, and 8th. It's outgrown, long since outgrown, the Jalopy Theater. And we hold the festival at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights, the beautiful St. Anne's Church, kind of a Gothic cathedral building on Montague Street. And the festival will feature about 40 different bands, as well as workshops, jam sessions, film screenings, and contests, and dances. It's really quite an extensive festival. It should be a really wonderful event. We have blues music and old-time string band music, music from Italy and Ireland and Turkey and Colombia and Mexico. And other places, there's incredible musicians coming not only from around the United States, but even from around the world, and also just featuring our own homegrown talent from here in Brooklyn and in New York City as a whole. Just a wonderful community of folk musicians here in New York that we really try to highlight at the festival.
I'm looking at an announcement for the festival, and I love some of the names of the performers. We have people like Feral Foster, the Birdman of Rome, the Brotherhood of the Jug Band Blues. Do you know all of these musicians, and does it take the whole year to do outreach and invite them?
Well, I'm the producer of the festival, and I do work on it all year. These are all musicians who I know personally, more or less, and I curate the festival, I book the festival. So it is very much my vision of what folk music is, which of course is a complicated term with a long history. But this festival is meant to showcase the diversity of what the idea of folk music is and, you know, to celebrate the people.
Eli, why is the people's music, folk music, or whatever you want to call it, it's not recognized by the mainstream media in terms of publicity or coverage? Why do you think it's such a struggle to keep your kind of folk art going?
Well, you're right, it's not, and that's why I appreciate being on Law and Disorder and being on WBAI and on Pacifica. Thank you for covering folk music and covering the Brooklyn Folk Festival. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is not booked based on celebrity or based on hype. And as a result of that, it makes it very hard for us to be represented in the mainstream media. It's hard to get the word out about the festival. And it's hard to honor the fabulous musicians that play at our festival in the way that they should be. And I would say that that's in my interactions with the music industry and with music journalists and the press. I should read you some of the interactions that I have or something like that, but they say, well, what's new this year? I say, nothing's new. We do the same thing every year. And not only that, the music is hundreds of years old. They, speaking in general of the music industry and press, have a obsession with things that are new that can be sold and hyped. And I hope that we at the Brooklyn Folk Festival challenge that idea in general of what originality is and what newness is. I think it's really it's a conceited thought to think that, you know, okay, I'm a singer-songwriter. That's what folk music is generally defined as, and there are many wonderful singer-songwriters out there. But I think it can be a conceited thought to say, well, look at me. This song that I wrote is totally original and therefore marketable, and you know, therefore you get all kinds of press. But everything is based strongly in the past and in music that's been developed over time in a, as I say, grassroots way. And you can't deny that, but I think it is denied.
I think that the essence of it is that capitalism requires products to be sold. And if the product isn't something new and tantalizing and can't be sold to make a profit, it isn't covered. I think our people's music suffers from the very system that it has to endure in.
Eli, social justice movements in the 30s and then in the 60s were accompanied by folk music. Why do you think that was, and is it still true today?
Well, I think social justice movements have been accompanied by music throughout time. But in the modern era, folk music became associated in the United States with progressive causes. I would say going back into the 1930s and the formation of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. A number of amazing musicians moved to New York City in the 1930s. Lead Belly moved to New York City in 1935. Pete Seeger dropped out of college and moved back to New York in 1939. You have incredible musician organizers coming up from the South to try to do fundraisers and get the word out about their causes in the 1930s. Aunt Molly Jackson comes to mind, an amazing woman from Kentucky who was involved in organizing the National Miners Union, once again in the CIO. But she was a great traditional musician. Woody Guthrie moved to New York in 1940. And so you had these musicians that were coming to New York for various reasons, but were masters of traditional or down-home, grassroots, whatever you want to call it, American music, often rural American music, music from the rural working class. And that jump-started an interest in so-called folk music here in New York City going back into the 1930s and into the 40s. People think of the 1960s as, you know, folk music in New York, but in fact it had really been percolating for like 20 years before that with really amazing artists doing important work. And it seems like in times of crisis like war or economic downturn or political crisis, the idea of, quote, folk music comes back. It's something that people who may be alienated or searching for something that they perceive as real can use to empower themselves, you know, culturally. I've been inspired recently watching social movements that have kind of sprung up in the last few years use music. I'm particularly impressed by the Poor People's Campaign that has come back, sort of the revival of Martin Luther King's last campaign that they've taken up again 50 years after his death. I was just watching something online the other day from the Poor People's Campaign, and they were using music in their organizing and in their events in a really wonderful community way.
Eli, you play the banjo, and the banjo has a very interesting history, and I wondered whether you could speak to that for a bit.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that the banjo is an African instrument. It came from West Africa, or really from the whole, there's banjo-like instruments all over the continent of Africa. And it was transported here in the mines, if not actually in the hands of enslaved African people that were brought here hundreds of years ago, and persisted in the United States. Originally, it was made out of a calabash gourd and had a sort of a round neck. And over time, with the Industrial Revolution and so on, the banjo became the modern instrument that we have today. It has sort of a modern drum head on it and a flat neck, but it's the instrument of African slaves, which then ran into other music that was here, including fiddle music and song traditions from Europe, from the Ireland and the British Isles, and elsewhere, and really created a wonderful and organic fusion of music. And it wasn't a premeditated fusion of music or something that's done in a very calculated way, as you often see today, but it's something that happened over hundreds of years and over a large territory, that fusion of African music with the banjo and other musical ideas and elements with the European music. That's what you hear today. And banjo music, a lot of people think of it as just a funny instrument, and of course it is, but it's also very deep and has deep roots. A lot of powerful music can be played on the banjo.
And we're going to hear some of that at the Brooklyn Folk Festival, no doubt.
Yeah, that's right. We have some really, really great banjo music, specifically at the Brooklyn Folk Festival this year. We have an awesome string band coming up from Georgia, really the premier Georgia string band. Clifton Hicks, also coming from Georgia, a great banjo player and ballad singer, who appeared on Law and Disorder a long time ago. talking about his experiences opposing the Iraq War. And Jaron Paxton, known as Blind Boy Paxton, is going to be there. He's an awesome banjo player. Everybody should look up Blind Boy Paxton. So there's a lot of great banjo music at the festival.
And Eli,
the festival
your
this
band
year.
Is the Downhill Strugglers, and in that band you often play the banjo, and I see that you've brought a cut of music with you. Would you please introduce that, and we'll share that with our listeners?
Well, I have a CD with me of live recordings from the Brooklyn Folk Festival, including some bands that'll be back this year. Actually, because it's our 10th anniversary year at the Brooklyn Folk Festival, we're actually bringing back a number of our favorite bands from the 10-year history of the festival. So maybe we can hear a selection from one of those bands.
And which one are you going to play for us?
Well, why don't we hear Jaron Blind Boy Paxton playing here. This is him playing guitar, not banjo. I mentioned that he plays the banjo as well. But here he is playing really a wonderful blues guitar piece called the Catfish Blues.
Jaron Blind Boy Paxton playing the Catfish Blues. Eli, what do you anticipate that some of the highlights of the Brooklyn Folk Festival are going to be?
Well, for some of you all that are paying attention, we do have some better-known bands there that you may have heard of. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is also a wonderful place to discover new music because we do book a lot of bands that are not presented elsewhere at festivals and who really deserve the kind of recognition that you get from playing on a big stage. So it's a wonderful place to discover new music. But for those of you that may have heard of them, Pokey Lafarge is playing. We got Pokey Lafarge coming down this year. That was Jerron Paxton that you heard. Spirit Family Reunion is going to be there. An incredible Moroccan band that was up for a Grammy this year, Inov Ganawa. I talk about how we don't book based on hype, but here I am. And Elizabeth Mitchell is going to be there with Suni Paz. Maybe some WBAI listeners have heard of the wonderful Suni Paz or Elizabeth Mitchell. They have a new children's album, an album of music for kids that just came out on the Smithsonian Folkways label. They'll be celebrating the release of their new album, so you might want to come down with the family for that one. The East River String Band is going to be there playing with R. Crumb, the well-known illustrator, who is also really a great musician. So you can check out East River String Band with R. Crumb.
And you play banjo in that band, don't you?
I have played with them. I've been on a few of their records.
Eli, how can people get more information about the festival?
The 10th Annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, coming right up April 6th, 7th, and 8th at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. Tickets are very reasonably priced, and you can see the whole schedule, all the information at brooklynfolkfest.com. So if you check out brooklynfolkfest.com, you can see all the bands and watch videos and get tickets and really see what we got going on there.
And bring your kids.
Fun for the whole family. There's two different square dances going on. Square dances are especially fun in the sense that you can just show up. The thing about square dancing is that they tell you what to do when you get there. They tell you how to do the dance. and we got some great square dance bands this year. It's going to be really, really cool, as well as a really hot salsa dance. We got a great salsa band this year. Willie Martinez is going to be there with his band, so you're not going to want to miss that stuff.
And you can go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, to get the information on the Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 6th, 7th, and 8th at St. Anne's Church on Montague Street in downtown Brooklyn. Eli Smith, disclosure here, you're my son, and it's
That's very, very
pleasing to have you on the show.
Thank you, Eli.
It's great to come down here every year and be with you all on Law and Disorder. It's such a treat. So thank you for having me on the show, and I hope all you listeners out there will come out to the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
See you in Brooklyn, Eli. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eli. You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
The whole wide world is left me for dead. Whole round nation about to overflow, leaving all your people nowhere to go. Red hot water most where you go, around this whole wide world. Well, the whole wide world is left me for dead. Whole round nation about to overflow, leaving all your people nowhere to go. If they hadn't left poor me for dead, I wouldn't be here today, standing on their steeples, looking me down, waiting for me to pray. The whole wide world has left me for dead. Whole round nation about to overflow, leaving all your people nowhere to go. Oh heish, what news to tell? Beneath the buzz of bees,
our bells. Well, water will come and take the dust, turn these shackles and chains all into rust. The whole wide, the whole wide, the whole wide world is let me dead. Whole round nation about to overflow, leaving all your people nowhere. Leaving all your people nowhere to go. Oh, ice, oh, ice, what news to tell? Neath the buzz of bees and flower bells, well, milk and honey swallow the land. Not before there's blood on every hand. One voice shall ring through every soul. Leave the wicked with no old place to go. Well, the whole wide, the whole wide, the whole wide world is let me. People nowhere. I said the whole wide, the whole wide, the whole wide world has left me for dead.